Trigger on!
Welcome, dear all, to the Darkface Diaries. We are a World Trigger read-through podcast aiming to discuss the World Trigger manga volume by volume. I'm Wensley Dale Cheddar.
And I'm Hoven with an H, and this month we'll be covering volume 22 of World Trigger, which comprises chapters 188 to 196, and is adapted across episodes 12 to 14 of season 3 of the anime.
That's correct, and today we welcome a very special guest. She is the host of Weekly Manga Recap, a purveyor of good-ass cats, a former contributor to Dice Funk, where her wonderful characters have managed to absolutely obliterate me emotionally time and time again. And I guess now she's a contributor to the Dice Funk credits, where they talk about Lost for 2 hours.
It's basically just a Lost podcast where we read a couple names eventually every so often. I think it's done now, because Austin has finished Lost now, so there's nothing more Lost to talk about. But
oh no, so there won't be any more episodes of the Lost podcast.
I know. Lost pod, yeah, we're going to replace it with something called the regular credits, where people actually paid to have their names read and not just listen to me talk about why I love Lost.
You know what? That sounds great. I'm not going to pretend like I'm disappointed that this is the only Lost podcast that there's going to be, because with my to watch list, it's going to like take us 5 years till we get to Lost eventually. So no worries about that.
Oh, keep those episodes saved in your back pocket then, for when you finally get through and you're like, oh, now I understand what they were talking about. I know what a Hurley is now.
Yes, exactly. This is why, you see, I decided to listen to it, even though I knew there would be spoilers, but because, you know what? Fuck it. In 5 years' time, I'm going to forget it all anyway, so that's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, when you don't know the plot to something, your head is like a sieve for spoilers.
That's how my memory works, so.
Let's welcome Quinn Larios, aka Rolo T. How are you doing, Les? It's so great to have you on the show again.
I am doing good. I'm enjoying that I get to relive one of my favorite parts of World Trigger again, and I get to talk with such outstanding individuals such as yourselves.
Aww.
The pleasure is all ours.
You know that we're the ones who are honored. This was weird syntax.
Nope, I'll fight you for it. I'll prove that it's more of an honor for me than it is for you.
No!
I can't actually fight you, though. I'm just going to cry a lot, but, like, you know. That's a way of fighting.
How do they say it in season 8 of in season 9 of Dice Funk right now? Homegang, is that right?
Homegang.
It's like a Nordic thing or something. I still don't know how it's spelled, but I googled it once.
Unless you're a master on it. That's how I feel whenever I google something.
Last time you were here, I was just starting to like listen to season 3, and now I finally caught up to witness you leave the show, which is excellent timing.
Well, you never know. I could be back around before you know it.
I'd love that.
Perhaps playing a garbage can controlled by a bunch of tiny mice who calls themselves Garbador, and all they do is devour everything they see. But then they struggle with alcoholism, and it's a downward spiral from there.
This would be just the fucking return of Pizza Rats from season 8.
Yes, pretty much.
I love how Hoven has no idea what we're talking about.
Nope, none whatsoever.
How have you been doing, Hose? What's been up with you?
I've been pretty good. Well, we've been rereading like some of the old RP adventures we got into on the forum that Quinn made, the One Piece RP forum. So that's been a trip down memory lane. It's very interesting reading your old writing after so long.
Couldn't do it. I don't know how you managed to do it, because that sounds like hell to me.
You know what? It's the same for me, Quinn, because our experiences with Hoven have been vastly different. I'm like, oh no, cringe. And Hoven's like, oh yeah, my writing was actually good back then.
I don't know. It's like, for me, it's like, I do see things that are like, oh, that's really cringe in hindsight, but I'm not repulsed by it. I'm like...
That must be nice.
Yeah, no, I've learned that that's not a good way to write. Yeah, I guess it's all a perspective thing. I really like revisiting old cringe projects that I used to make that I now feel above. It's weird.
I can be like that. I'm always like, no, I wish I was perfect from the start. No.
It's painful. I don't know how you do it. Every like, even the very concept. Like, it took me the better part of a decade to just get used to listening to myself on a podcast I may have recorded hours previously and not be like, you're so dumb. Why did you say that? That wasn't funny. I hate you. I want to just cut all your lines out, but then no one would know who you were talking to.
That's a bit of a pity. I love your old WMR episodes. I've just recently remembered, speaking of both this and the forum, that like back when you were recapping like Gakuhote, I think you made the character Bosco from like the invasion event. Uh-huh. I think you like based him on, what was it, Tonto from Gakuhote?
I just remember we made Tonto very stupid. Like Tonto would just shout out their own name and explain thoughts in the way we make WMR characters, which is usually that they're just very dumb.
Yeah.
And then Bosco attacked the Le Grand Hole in Linmar Island, which, incidentally, was that a Zoe Legrand from Dice Funk reference?
I don't think so. I feel like it was before that. I just have a dumb brain that just occasionally pulls old things out and forgets where they came from. So that feels more likely to me.
There we go. Now I'm wondering what inspired what, then.
I would assume the Oda forum thing came first, because I don't believe I was still doing that by the time. Like, I remember writing Zoe, and just, I was like, I need a really fancy last name, and I went with LeGrand. So it was probably just digging back into the same hole of my own head, which undoubtedly I probably unconsciously took from some other piece of media I consumed at one point and forgot to. Someone's like, is it a reference to so-and-so from Futurama? Probably. I've forgotten, unfortunately.
Maybe there was a common reference that inspired both. This is, we need to examine it scientifically. Maybe.
Yeah. If you hunt it down, you'll also find my treasure.
Ah, okay.
Hidden at the answer of all these riddles. It's my One Piece.
Well, in any case, you might be mistaken that we're talking about One Piece, our One Piece forum adventures, but no, we are still talking about World Trigger.
And you can give all these adventures a look at... Oh no, the forum hosting website shut down.
please don't look for them. Today we are talking about Volume 22 of World Trigger, story and art done, as always, by Daisuke Ashihara, translated done by Caleb Cook, touch-up and lettering done by the great Ace Cole Chrisman, designed by Julian J.R. Robinson, and edited by Ray First. We're going to start with a bit of a summary of the volume, then we'll move on to our general thoughts, and then we'll move straight on to the Q&A. If that sounds good, then shall we begin?
Yeah.
Yes.
All right.
Tamakoma 2 try their best to get on the move again in the wake of Chika's detonation. Chika blames herself for the error, but Osamu insists that it's his fault for his orders. After debating the pursuit of Tonooka, the squad resolves to continue moving towards Hughes instead, all while maintaining high alert. As Hughes gets continually weared down on all sides by the assault of the brawl, Konami's commentary keeps insisting that he turns things around, until she eventually lets slip that he has a secret weapon up his sleeve, which Karasuma clues Kitora in on. Ikoma readies his signature whirlwind, leading Hughes to attempt an escape maneuver. The neighbor launches Ikoma into the air with Escudo before attempting to make a break for it. However, he is forced to double back as Ikoma unleashes a mid-air whirlwind, losing Hughes' other foot in the process. The various squad read Hughes' intent as a scuppered path of escape. He was after Ninomiya, attempting to unleash his hidden weapon on the squad captain. Hughes fires back as the neck tightens, launching a goddamn car into Obashima with Escudo as she tries to pressure him into Ikoma Squad's line of fire. But there's only so long he can manage, and Hughes knows this. He unleashes his ace in the hole on Ikoma, bypassing his shield with his until now unknown Vipers and taking out the behemoth of an ace.
Honestly, there's not enough car throwing in World Trigger.
There really isn't.
I'm disappointed that it took so long.
There should be as much as there is in, like, the game Hulk Ultimate Destruction for the PS2 and Xbox. Sure.
Oh, imagine if Chika walked up and smashed a car in half and then turned each car into a boxing fist to punch people with. That'd be so cool.
Do not mess with my bird daughter. He attempts to redirect some of the stray fire at Kai as he opportunistically attacks the swooshy haired neighbor, but his counter is blocked by Mizukami's shields, and Kai's attack strikes true. Hughes is defeated. As guilt swirls in Chika's head in response to this, Hughes's voice comes over the intercom. Rather than solely assure her as Osamu did, he urges her to protect Osamu and Yuma in his place. The ensuing opportunity attack from Yuba Squad loses Ikoma Squad Kai's arm and the entire body of Mizukami. The squad disperses with Yuba pursuing Inukai and Obashima. Osamu suggests that Chika use Hound from now on to avoid situations like before with Tonooka, but the Tamakoma sniper decides to go a step further, using clever positioning to bait out her pursuer while shielding herself, before launching her Hound volley at his location, Toraoka flees the building, but is taken out midfall by Oki, the kill-stealing motherfucker. This, however, grabs the attention of Ninomiya, who lures the visor-wearing sniper right into Snooji's sneak attack. Yuma reaches Kai and Obashima, prompting what seems to be a Mexican standoff against the white-haired neighbor, but then Obashima surprise attacks the vulnerable Ikoma Squad attacker, taking whatever points her team can get. Yuma keeps up the offensive on Inukai, unfazed by his attempts to persuade him off his trail by the gunner. As Tsuji swoops in to take the head off, we get some establishment of Yuma's dual guns from the commentators. We learn that it was inspired by Sua's shotguns, but its fire distance is an excellent counter for Kagetsu Whirlwinds, able to hit just outside its range provided he can keep his distance, and that Ikoma Whirlwind was created specifically to counter it. Still on the ropes at the hands of the relentless gunfire, Ninomiya squad members are saved from by the building-leveling debut of their captain. Kuga lures Obashima into the wire zone laid out by Osamu, putting her on the ropes. She counters with a fanning spray of bullets, abandoning any attempt to attract him accurately. Kuga launches a scorpion her way, before activating Grasshopper just as she deflects. It's another of Midorikara's very own pinball techniques, this time with a scorpion at its heart. Obashima is worn down, and more crucially, distracted, as Yuma moves in to strike the finishing blow, assuring her that she will get stronger. Yuba Squad is down to just its captain. Wednesdaydale?
Oh, now it's me. Okay. Alright. Oh no, my heart. Okay. As Osama and Yuma reveal themselves, the climactic battle of the final round starts. So Kuga initiates the battle with a scorpion projectile, but Ninomiya responds with a volley of meteors, making the shrimp run for his life and demolishing any wires Mikimo had set up in the process. Osama attacks from the back, counting on the suits being wary of Chika's sniping, but he is not able to split their focus as they don't even see him as a threat. A volley of cross asteroid breaks Yuma's defenses as Ninomiya taunts the Tamakoma ace. He laments the fact that Chika can't shoot to kill and states that Osama poses no threat to them. But then, Yuma's side effect kicks in. He catches it as a lie. Suddenly, Osama throws his ray gust with his thruster at Ninomiya, beefcake style. Yuma throws his scorpion simultaneously to the side, bounces it back with Grasshopper, and they both fly the number one shooter. He manages to stop one with his shield, while Tsuji knocks down the other using his sword. Then Chika shoots a lead bullet at the enemy's captain, but Inukai intercepts it with his arm and cuts off the elbow stump. Chika guards against the counterattack with a full shield. Ninomiya makes a gamble, sending both teammates after the sniper, facing both Osama and Yuma on his own. Vorice orders Chika to guard with lead bullets and to leave Ninomiya to them. Back in the audience, I guess Miwa is reading fucking minds now since he knows Osama hasn't given the order to shoot to kill. Oji wonders why Ninomiya sent both his lackeys after Chika, but then everything pops into place momentarily. Tsuji turns around and launches himself at the defenseless Mikimo, prompting Hughes to say, "Now." In a beautiful two-page spread, Chika breaks the glass window with her ibis and aims at Tsuji. The shot predictably goes past the concentrated shield, so he pulls up a roof tile to defend against what he expects to be a lead bullet. But that's the thing. It isn't one. So Tsuji fucking explodes. This finally faces his captain, at which point Osama sees an opening. He shoots a volley of Trine bullets, which nearly miss Ninomiya. But wait, no! The bullets curve! And as Ninomiya focuses on shooting Yuma, Osama's hound homes in on Ninomiya to skewer him. Yuma shields himself and Grasshopper's in to footstab Ninomiya, destroying his Trine supply. So, as Inukai reaches Chika, he suddenly reveals he has been a Haikyu character all along and says, "Nice kill," promptly offing the sniper and bailing out. As the match ends, Osama is quite surprised that Chika managed to take her shot. Osami wants to pamper her, but Hughes just respectfully compliments her on her battle. As the absolute dork he is, Hughes wants fist bumps with everyone, and we cut to the commentary team reviewing the match. Oji draws attention to how impressive it was that Hughes lasted this long with the unlucky position he had. He was avoiding Ikoma's whirlwind through the house, which was an especially tricky feat, a testament to Usami's operating skills. Kurouchi reveals Yuma's curving shuriken as essentially a scorpion yo-yo, or I guess a Beyblade would be a better comparison, using one scorpion to make a string for the other, allowing to curve in its path. Sakuraka wonders if the previous lead shot prior to killing Tsuji was a feint, but it would have made no tactical sense not to ibis them at the time. Osama asks if Hughes was the one who gave the order to shoot, but claims it was all Chika's call. So Four Eyes apologizes for not having enough faith in her and thanks her for saving him with her decision. Osama's team placement is assured, but Yuba's isn't yet. The rank wars are coming to a close, but next time we are going to see the last hurrah as we say goodbye to Akane in the last match of the season between Katori, Nasu, and Sewer Squads. General thoughts?
Let's do it.
Let's go.
We've been saying stuff for a while, so Gwen, what were your thoughts on this volume?
This volume's so good. Like, this already was like a really good match with a lot of really interesting stuff going on. Just like the way the rank wars function creates so many different opportunities. It's been said many times, it's basically a sports manga. Just they invented a new sport. And it just creates new scenarios every time. This one, it's like, hey, last match you got to see Hughes just absolutely stomp everybody. And this one, you just have to see him on the back foot the entire time, just trying to survive. And he keeps coming up with cool tricks to use to make things awesome. But he's like essentially stuck in like a 6-on-1 the entire time. And it just creates this like dramatic tension that slowly builds up. You get a lot of like cool standout small moments from characters who, ironically, now because of the current arc we're in, not to spoil anything going on there, but several of those characters are more significant at that point. Now I can retroactively go back and be like, oh, the guy with the visor. That's like, I know who he is. I know that character.
He didn't come out of nowhere just being, Osama's best bunker friend.
Yeah, I was like, yeah, you know, it turns out he's not Urafune. There can be two people with hats in Border.
You can totally see how Mizukami would be a super genius. He, you know, is good at applying shields at opportune times. I mean, to be fair, being the sole brain cell on Ikoma Squad is pulling a lot of heavy weight.
Yes.
I was going to say, he has to do a lot of work to actually manage what he's trying to do. But all that said, it's such a great conclusion this builds up to like establish. World Trigger came out, 2013? I think, like, the invasion kind of ended in, like, 2014 or something like that. 2015, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just had rank wars forever. Just rank wars. And then, like, a small miniature invasion. And then more rank wars. And then the series went on hiatus for a year. And then it came back. And we still had more rank wars. And, like, there were, like, delays. And Ashihara's, like, kind of adjusting to different schedules. So when the chapter came out where Chika shoots to kill and Osamu defeats Ninomiya with Kuga's help, that was like 6 years removed from when the series started and like 5 years removed from when the rank war started, and we've kind of been leading up to this. So it's almost like a super Wano when you think about it, and to place it in One Piece terms. Like, we've been waiting a while for that payoff, and when it finally happened, it was done in the best Ashihara World Trigger kind of way, where it is subversion of the absolute trope, but absolutely still an optimistic and like hopeful shonen protagonist moment. Like, it's not like, oh, Osamu believed in his friends and he shot Ninomiya in his face and did it because he had more Tron because he believed in his friends. Like, no, he had to use like weird tactics to do it, and even then he doesn't get the kill himself. Kuga has to come in to get the finishing blow. But it's like, yeah, they beat him, and there's just so many cool moments buried within that.
I especially loved how like Osama's hound plan was like to lean into Ninomiya thinking that he's useless. Asteroid is usually like the best option for him, since like those villains can pack a punch with a relatively low Trion, so they can make up for his weak Trion levels. Of course, Ninomiya wouldn't expect him to change his bullets now. Why would he? And why would he pay attention to the fact that the bullets are a little weaker than usual? With Hughes, Inukai paid attention last volume, but why would they pay attention to Osamu? It's perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, them influencing the narrative of the battle is a really recurring thing here. You have Hughes making his big finale as last minute and as dramatic as possible so that everyone stops paying as much attention to Tanakoma 2. And it takes, yeah, it takes even the possibility that Osamu could do something like that completely off anyone's minds. And I think another example is less intentional, but the fact that Chika was not able to muster up the ability to shoot people until the very end of the battle also played into that sort of narrative, where they didn't expect her to do that, so only ever accounted for her not being able to shoot them directly.
Yes, this fight is a blast, thanks to the fact that, like, the tension is through the roof. And yeah, as you said, the characters are, like, evolving, and their techniques here never fail to impress me with the creativity. The fucking pinball machine.
Yeah.
This is a bit of a debate I had at one point. Like, is Scorpion Pinball too OP? I've kind of been mulling over this for ages.
I guess that they specifically made it so like you can shoot the grasshoppers and like get rid of the platforms. But
yeah.
Even so, they kind of had to make the distinction. Oh yeah, a scorpion is totally different from a gunner's Tryon bullet. That's right.
They have someone like pop in to say like, oh, if Obishima were a bit more of an experienced combatant, she would have probably realized she could have gotten out of it, but she didn't, because, you know, that's like her character trait flaw, is like, she's really ambitious, but she's young and inexperienced still.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wish the setting perhaps was a little more distinct. I don't think it would have distracted much from the overall tension to have like a bit more interesting setting rather than a regular cityscape.
Yeah, they were very much going for the big finale happening in kind of the most generic world trigger setting for a battle you could have, which, you know, it's functional, but yeah, there's not really much to the setting itself. Fairly straightforward cityscape.
I guess I like how the anime embellishes it with like having it take place during sunset.
Yeah, although I think that's only really at the end. If we want to get into my anime corner, the final one, it's one of the most tightly compressed of the chunks that we've gone through. It's like an entire volume in 2.5 episodes. Granted, they do completely skip over the post-match commentary, since I think ending the series on an emotionally satisfying note with Chika's victory was the focus, and with good reason.
Mm.
The domino effect of Hughes being taken out is paced perfectly. Like, I feel like a season one type production would just have, like, everything linger a bit and kind of be a bit awkwardly slow. But here, just the following takedowns and breakoffs from the brawl are just like, bam, bam. They just, one after the other, they're relentlessly quick, which is great. And also, they really compensate on Yuba's relative lack of consequence in the battle by just going full ham on any animation of him running to try and get in range of someone. Like, his chase with Tsuji is really intense, and his attempt to get to Minamiya in particular is treated as this huge spectacle. There's like a big dynamic shot of him kind of ascending up the rubble like it's this big mountain.
Oh yeah, I think I remember during the spoiler corner for our Volume 9 episodes, Quinn, you mentioned that Yuba was a bit of a disappointment back then to you. How do you feel about him rereading it? About the same?
It's still not great considering how much of like a build-up there was towards him leading into it, which made sense. They were the one new team in a group of four teams where we know the other three very intimately at this point. So there was a lot of build-up, and it felt like Obishima actually got more of a focus than Yuba. Like, there is such a lead-up to, like, Yuba is this attacker killer, and he has a plan to show off with Ninomiya and potentially kill him. And it just kind of, like, Ninomiya just absolutely nukes him. Which doesn't lead to, like, the most satisfying, like, payoff, but then it's also this thing where we've now established that the end of the Rank Wars was also kind of a setup for the arc that came after it, and potentially more with the eventual away mission. Like, these might be characters who were getting groundwork set in to kind of establish who they are, and they just couldn't have a chance to shine in this arc because there were, like, only, like, 6 spotlights and, like, 20 characters who needed time in them. So Yuba was just a character who doesn't leave the strongest impression beyond being, like, a cool gunslinger in this series. But I still like this one.
Yeah, I guess maybe if, like, he got a nice kill beforehand, like, for example, finishing off Hughes, maybe.
He does get a kill before that. I forget against who.
He got a kill on Mizukami.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, see, he's better than Mizukami, and Mizukami is the best. He's, like, a super genius, as we find out later. So that was, like, the big moment. But again, that only comes in context once you read the next arc, so, you know. That's that area.
I guess that's still, like, pretty cheap since, like, it's a volume extra. I forget which volume. I think the one that introduces Ikoma Squad does mention that he likes shogi, and, oh yeah, he's kind of a chess master. He's actually quite intelligent. So they did technically set it up beforehand, just not in the actual story, so.
In fairness, anyone in that group is going to be overshadowed by Akoma themselves, so it's just natural that, like, you wouldn't actually remember the details of what all these other characters actually do, because you're like, dude, Akoma's great, just talks about wanting, like, plums and doing his cool slash attack.
And his side effect is seeing into the fourth wall.
Yeah.
Just throughout this volume, the chain of action beats reacting to each other is really strong. Like, Hugh's being taken out, it sets Tamakoma 2 back in some regards, but in turn works out in their favor. His taking out of the Akoma also allows Yuba to act with less restraint, with the Akoma whirlwind being his natural counter. Then you have, like, the domino effect of Chika luring out Konooka, which follows by Oki taking him out, and then Ninomiya and Tsuji notice this and then eliminate Oki. I usually try and streamline the summary a little, but because of this, it just becomes really hard to do anything but just clearly repeat the battle in full chronological order, because that's the only way you can summarize it in a way that makes sense.
Coming back to what you said about, like, the ending in the anime, it's definitely a lucky break in this volume that Nasa's match is at the beginning of the next one rather than at the tail end of this one. Otherwise, it would have been a bit of a wet fart at the end for, like, the finale of the rank wars. I think the Nasa match will be an important one to, like, decompress after the resolution of all this, but structurally it's going to be, like, best as its own thing along with the pre-away mission test stuff.
I have an important question. Going through and rereading everything again, there's a moment, it looks like Ninomiya has dodged Osamu's attacks, and he's now aiming all of his bullets at Koga, who's kind of defenseless in the air. It looks like everything's done. Cut to everybody's different faces and everything like that, and then it just, like, centers in on Osamu and Karasuma saying, like, we win, and you see the bullets curve, and then it, like, cuts to Konami, who's, like, stood up, like, head in her hands, like, screaming. And is that not the reaction I feel like almost all of us had when we first read this chapter? Like, it's the exact feeling when you're like, oh, no!
Holy shit!
It's like that exact moment.
Yes, I definitely had to stand up. I love how excited Konami gets during this commentary. Every time there's like a tense moment, you can see like her sweat drops on her face. She puts her hands in the air with tears in her eyes. Someone who has very expressive physical reactions, I totally get that. I also love how she can't help but fucking reveal all the secrets to everyone while she's in the commentary team. I know that like the actual teams who are fighting can't hear her, but still, Konami, what are you doing?
And she also gives her girlfriend a nice compliment at the end, and she's giving Shiori's operating skills a shout out.
No, excellent. When we had Kendra on, we talked about how sometimes it seems like Ashihara doesn't really want to give Chika her own voice, and here, I kind of got the vibe that the boys are still, like, treating her a bit like she doesn't have one. But they do point out that they shouldn't be doing this at this point, coming in on the fact that she made her own decision. At least that's kind of my interpretation. At first, like, I wasn't sure whether it was actually Hughes who gave the order to shoot, and that's what she did, or whether it was actually Chika making her own choice at that point, but I think I lean towards the latter.
At the very least, so with that last scene, it might have been that he told her to shoot and was going to clarify, but make sure you don't use red lead bullets, but then she did that part on her own. It is definitely a recurring thing throughout the volume. Like, Chika's weeding out of Tonooka is a improvisation that deviated from Osamu's directions attack. He never told her to do that. He just told her to start using houndbone enemies, and then she kind of took it a step further. And yeah, there is also that detail of, yeah, that Osamu alone can't help Chika overcome her guilt. He, like, tries to just assure her the same way he used to and redirects the blame to himself, which is a very common tactic for him. But in the end, it's Hughes foisting the responsibility onto her that gives her the push that she needs. It's like, in a way, her sense of guilt and responsibility towards her teammates is sort of leveraged as a tool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think like earlier on, Usami was the one who kind of started saying that she really needs to coddle Chika because she really didn't care about her own life and was always trying to sacrifice herself. And I think like it's nice seeing her reach the point where she doesn't really need that, and she needs like Hughes' trust in her as a fighter. She desperately needs that push.
There's definitely like going to be a thing when it comes to Chika where she is such a, I don't want to call it introverted, but she is this character who needs so much, like she ambitiously wants to do things, but every step of the way she kind of needs someone there to push her through that. and so much of the series is about her, whether or not she's willing to shoot people and how could she actually capitalize on this crazy power and everything like that. And they do dig into certain things, like explain, like, oh, well, maybe she could have used that shot there, but she was worried, you know, hey, what if she had hit someone of her teammates, and then, you know, maybe you would have traumatized her even further and things like that. Like, I don't want to say she has never owned voice. I think she does fall into this sense of, like, she is the member of the team who needs orders in another team that probably would just be the case for most of the members, but Tamakoma is one leader and then two super aces who are, like, experts at war, so they don't really need as many, like, concrete directions, but it does come off a little bit strange.
Hmm. I mean, one thing I did notice in this match was that a lot of the time, Tamakoma score a lot of ground by the members acting independently. You have, like, Hughes specifically choosing where he wants to use his Viper reveal. You have Yuma dealing with Obishima in his own way. Like, Osamu is often influencing them in more general ways sometimes.
Which is fair, like, they have to be special in that sense because, like, they are the main cast, and when you have a main cast, you usually want all of them to have a certain degree of agency. I guess, yeah, Chika's kind of, I want to say, passivity, maybe, stands out, but it's nice to know that this volume implicates that there is an arc to it. It's not going to stay the same. Hughes generally uses first names for everyone because he's not from Japan, but then randomly he uses the surname for Kuga, I guess, in the spirit of rivalry. He uses one for Jin as well, so maybe, yeah, because of that. He also is quite antagonistic towards Jin. I like Hughes getting the win on Ikoma. It was nicer as, like, a payoff to the earlier duel. As we kind of mentioned in the last episode, you have the setup of, is Hughes going to be the key player against the encounter with Ninomiya? But no, it actually pays off on an earlier thing he had with Ikoma. Do you remember Izumi Quinn? I know that he hasn't been name-dropped in a while.
Not Izumi Squad, right? Is that what you mean? No, it's Izuma.
He's from Tachikawa Squad, like the blonde one.
He has a very nondescript design. It's fairly easy to...
I remember there's the number one shooter guy.
I thought he was the number one shooter too, but it turns out it was Ninomiya. So he's the guy you think of, but he's not the number one shooter apparently, but he's in the number one squad, so...
Huh.
In any case, I was going to say, he is just like Kokoro, the train lady from One Piece.
Interesting.
He just shows up every now and again, and he's like, hey, 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 now things are getting interesting. He keeps saying that over and over during this match.
I was just going to say, a lot of great dynamic action, I think, in this. Yusei sending up the car to, or the Escudo to slam a car to Obishima, just like the barrage of bullets going down on Yuba when he's trying to crawl towards Ninomiya, like the mid-air spin Ikoma whirlwind. There's a lot of like really great dynamic movement within this arc. I agree with what you said that they probably could have picked a more memorable final location, but I do think they took advantage of that as much as possible. Like, even in this moment, like reading through it, I was like, oh, there's a moment when Yusei is on the back foot so much, and he waits until he's about to hit an alleyway before he summons this wall of Escudo, so he basically creates another alleyway for himself to dart down. And I was like, that's pretty cool, like, visual. There's a lot of, like, interesting visuals. I should stop saying the word visual so many times. but there's a lot of really cool elements that I liked watching with my eyes. However you would describe that, some kind of noun of some kind.
Visual elements, one might say. I don't... hang on, let me check. Thesaurus. Visual. Ocular. Optic. Optical. Beheld. Discernible. There we go.
Yeah. There's a lot of optical enjoyment had in these chapters. It's like when there was like the thing where someone was like, video game journalism's really bad because like they posted like a description of a video game being like, the graphics are so transcendent and awesome, and someone was like, well, that's not so bad. They're like, yeah, this was applied to like Call of Duty that was actually from Banjo-Kazooie in 1996. Like, that's how nondescript this actual description is.
Amazing. If you think about it, Banjo-Kazooie is exactly like Call of Duty.
They're pretty much the same. They even added a first-person shooter mode in the sequel.
Oh my god, is that true?
Yeah, you get to like walk around in a certain couple stages, like using Kazooie like an actual rifle and shooting eggs at people.
I really need to play a collectathon again. Like, I had a ukulele in my library for, like, it feels like ages now, but I've never touched it yet.
Yeah, I have that with a lot of things. It's entirely nostalgia, though. It is 100% just, like, I want to feel like I'm 8 years old playing the N64 again. Because, like, truthfully, collectathons are only fun for so long, and eventually I just get frustrated and annoyed by them, especially because I don't live in an age of, like, oh, I'm going to have a strategy guide right to my side that I'll just look through to find where all the secrets are. It's like, I'm going to have to navigate a bunch of YouTube videos and IGN articles to find out where this stupid last Jinjo is. I think the last thought I would have about this volume is that, now I don't know, are they planning to do more of the anime?
I highly doubt they will for like at least another 5 years, if not more.
Yeah. In that way, World Trigger, I believe, now can join the ranks of illustrious fellow members like Ice Shield 21 in having an anime that ends before the actual conclusion of the manga, but probably ends at a better point than them. Like, because this, look, we don't know where World Trigger is going to go. Once the away mission happens, probably sometime in 2033, you know, we'll be able to be like, wow, this is incredible and amazing, and who knows. But as it is right now, the end of this match and the showdown with Ninomiya and everything that leads up to it is such an amazing payoff and so well executed that it is tough to even comprehend something rivaling that same high anywhere near in the future. So for them to kind of be like, this is the end of the anime for right now, I think is like a kind of a cool move, because, like, yeah, the story still has places to go. But in terms of like a high, like, you're not going to beat this.
Mm-hmm. Where did the Ice Shield anime end? Like, just before the Christmas Bowl?
It ended right after the Ojo Knights match. They don't even finish the Kanto tournament. So,
oh my god.
The Hakusho match doesn't happen yet. Like, there's some build-up to it, but they don't get to that. It ends right after that match. And I myself am of that mindset of, I was like, that was the best match in Ice Shield 21, though. Like, I think that was the top of a match. So, like, in my mind, I was like, yeah, go off on the highest note you can, you know?
Yeah, I think I remember enjoying the last match of the content tournament somewhat, but it definitely speaks volumes that I can't remember what the team it was.
It was the Dinosaurs, and it's a fine match. I'm not even trying to insult that match. I'll insult the Christmas Bowl and the World Cup arc, but the Dinosaurs match is fine. But it, like, it was always going to be like a step down from that White Knights match, which was like, oh, holy crap. Like, every step of this match was just, yes, like pure drama all the way, yes, through. So, like, that's where the anime ends. And this is kind of the same thing where it's just like, yeah, maybe we don't get through the whole story, but, like, I don't know. We played Welcome to the Back Parade and then we got off stage, because where do we go from there? You know, let's just go home, everybody.
I really need to read Ice Shield. I know I'm going to enjoy it at least somewhat. I quite liked what I saw of the anime, but it was just horribly paced and animated, so...
Yeah, I was going to say, there's a lot less, like, power auras and stuff like that in the manga, but it's a great series. It's a really good one.
Yeah, it's one of the ones that, like, I plan to read soon. It's just I'm slowly chipping away at Vinland Saga right now, which is excellent.
So. Oh my god, I'm just remembering the fucking Yukimitsu moment in the Ojo match. I just so need great. To reread that match, honestly.
Yes, it's so good. Every moment of that match is great. Like, there's so many moments of, like, I'm going to do this. And then, like, someone else, like, well, I'm countering with that. And, like, oh, I expected you to counter with that, so I'm going to do this. Which is normally one of the most frustrating things in anime. But because you like both teams so much, you're like, yeah! And then you pop for the other guy. And like, yeah! And it's so cool, man. It's such a great arc and such a great match.
Yes. Speaking of, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. Perfect. I'm tying this back into the thing we're discussing, because I still have more notes. All right. So, yeah, I like the history behind the techniques. Yuba basing his style on the Suez shotguns to counter the rage of Kagetsu Whirlwind. Then Ikoma did his to like counter Yuba. It's fun how Escudo and Grasshopper just became ways to catapult things when used by the neighbors. They like use it completely differently to what the the Earthlings would. Oh, we're cutting between a lot of the random agents for the commentary compared to most matches I've noticed, which makes sense, but because like we want to see them, all the notable ones for the final matches. So we get Kitora, we get Miwa, who we haven't seen like in ages.
Yeah, we get Arafune, we get Kakizaki.
We definitely get recolored Jin. Oji seems like a fancy lad, but it seems like he's got some regional accent sneaking in, which it's an interesting bit because I thought it was like Ikoma Squad's thing. Yeah, I can't seem to find a mention of him coming from like non-Kanto region, but I wonder what the reason behind it is. I can't seem to find it on Wiki. Hound, to me, seemed like the easiest bullet to grasp, but like the factor of it, if you set the homing to 100%, it's easy to block. Makes me go, oh yeah, okay, I guess it's like much more complicated than I thought, with like the homing property being adjustable. Then there's the like theorizing in the audience of whether Chika can shoot or not. I thought it was well done in that it kind of added an additional level of tension to the match. There's already so many different factors to cover, so having that in consideration throughout the whole match was nice. It's funny how Izuho is just like part of Tamakoma now, the C-rank sniper.
The honorary Tamakoma branch member.
Yeah, yeah. She just hangs out with them at the base. It's just, without a doubt. Which kind of makes me wonder if like Narsa Squad is going to follow suit at some point, maybe. Maybe like when Osamu and the others come back from the away mission at some point, they come back to Earth and Narsa Squad is like Tamakoma 3 now. It's interesting that for a lot of this fight, Inukai is the point of view character. Since we get his like internal thoughts a lot, I guess it's kind of like an interesting way to like see Hughes and the others as the threat and him as the one being in control there.
Just because Tsuji has such a kind of shy, stoic disposition and Ninomiya is never going to let down the facade, he's the only one who could have that kind of playful inner monologue regarding the others. It's the only member of that team it really fits with.
Mm-hmm. And I guess my last note is that I didn't really mention it in the recap, but it's nice that like they cover the pretty fair point of, hey, why doesn't Chika use Hound or Meteor like all the time with her Trion? Oh yeah, it could stress her out if she like accidentally hit an ally and this would affect her performance, so yeah. All right. Anything more to mention, you two, or should we move on to the Q&A?
I'm good to move on.
Let's do this!
Hey!
That's a wrestling reference.
Let's do this!
There was a wrestler, Brock Lesnar. You had to watch it at some point, because I reference it all the time, and it's very funny. There's a wrestler, Brock Lesnar, who's fucking huge. He's like 6'5", giant muscles, everything mm-hmm. like that. Generally doesn't talk, because he's more intimidating when he doesn't talk. But someone like challenges him to a fight, and he grabs the mic, and he's like, "Let's do this!" And like his voice rises, and kind of ends like a question. Everyone's just like, "What?
Ron Burgundy?
I'm here. Let's do this!"
Yeah,
I love this. Let's do balls of sand. This.
Yeah, this.
The only stuff I know from wrestling is like from watching Little Karibo's Mark Remark videos. I do know who Brock Lesnar is. I recall more moments with The Big Show or Roman Reigns.
Roman, Rousey, Ronda Reigns, it's all the same to me.
Ah, lovely.
It tickles me so much.
it is a great moment. right. Let's move on to the Q&A then.
Now that I've explained my one-off comment and taken about 7 minutes.
You know what, that's fine. Like a few episodes ago, we like took a few minutes to watch with Allison like a few trailers for the Pinocchio movie. That was the Pauly Shore one.
That's pretty good.
Father, where can we go to the Q&A? Here we go.
Do it now. I can't believe my I can't believe my eyes. We've got a question. I got an email question from Anna. All right, you D&D nerds. If Osamu were a character in a D&D campaign, what would his class, subclass, and ability score roughly be? What about the other main characters? So yeah, my multiple D&D tangents I've made throughout this podcast finally pays off.
Very nice. I will say I'm still a bit of a beginner to D&D. I have made a couple of characters, but I haven't been in a campaign for more than a year, I think. But I have, like, rough guesses.
Shall we go through each main character and give all our various... what we put forward.
Okay, I mostly concentrated on the ability score, so since that was nice and easy, but I suppose you two will have more interesting comments on the classes, which I don't know as much.
Okay, so for Osamu, I was really tempted with Battlemaster Fighter, which is where it focuses on a fighter that uses maneuvers to kind of influence the battlefield a bit, but then I thought about it, and I wasn't quite sure. I feel like it's a bit of an easy trap to fall into with this, to have everyone be a fighter class that uses weapons, and I think maybe of the ones that I know, War Cleric might be a bit more fitting. It's like mid-range, there is an element of influencing your teammates, but it's not quite as overbearing, because I don't think Osamu is quite a full grand strategist. I think he is able to pull out situational tactics. And War Cleric is good for that, with All God's Blessing. And also, it's a really poorly optimized class, which is great, because Osamu is a poorly optimized fighter. God, War Priest, it becomes functionally useless very, very quickly, unless you have, like, a cool GM who can, like, be very flexible with what attack action means, or just give you a special item that makes it a little more versatile. But yeah. What about you, Quinn? What would you give? Which class would you give Osamu?
I feel like, so I was trying to think along your lines. I was like, what class and subclass would kind of work? And I was like, there's like Arcane Archer, Fighter, which is like different specialty tricks and things like that. It's kind of always called like the Hawkeye kind of class or the Green Arrow class. And a lot of different things. But then I realized, I was like, I feel like what Osamu is a really bad multi-class. Like, he's like one level fighter, one level wizard, one level cleric. Like, he's like all these very small things, which does not help him like stand against like a level like 5 just single class target, because he's just poorly optimized. But he has all these different tricks and tools in his kit that he can use, that he finds creative ways to use it.
Yeah, that also makes a lot of sense with how he advances throughout the story, where for a while he just tries to cheese it with Ray Gust, and that alone does not end up being enough. So then he moves on to using Spider, and he's always trying to use new tricks.
Yeah, like, there's always... But nothing's, like... He doesn't have any of the cool stuff from it. He can't do any, like, combination stuff or anything like that. It's just, like, he hasn't gotten this subclass in any class yet, because he just keeps dipping into a new class, basically.
Interesting. I put him as, like, a wizard. I haven't played a wizard, but I assume there's a lot of preparation involved, and like, he has like these different maneuvers and these different kind of spells that he can use, but like they're very situational. But he can't, like, for example, use meta magic to like make his techniques hit a little stronger. Like, he also doesn't have the try on that would kind of allow him to use his resources more frequently. Like, for example, a warlock. I think I defaulted to a spellcaster, but because like I guess that's the kind of visual reference I have. Try-on cubes always seem like spells to me. For his, like, ability scores, I put 4 in strength, I put 6 in dexterity, he can avoid stuff somewhat. Then I put 3 in constitution, I kind of equated it to his try-on level, which is abysmal. I put, I guess, 16 in intelligence, since, like, he does research stuff and does know what things do, even if he can't apply them all the time, and like he needs a lot of preparation. With wisdom, I put 13, above average, but he's kind of a dummy sometimes, and like it needs, for example, Kitora to point out how useful a spider would be in his case. For charisma, I put 18, because surprisingly, he's like everyone's friend, everyone takes an interest in him. I think it's only fitting.
Yeah, I mean, I always saw him as kind of like a middle-of-the-road charisma who just gets really good roles, but that also works.
Yeah, yeah. But because he's mild-mannered, I didn't put straight 20.
Okay, and then we have Yuma. I actually split this up. So for Black Trigger, I think he's a Pact of the Undead warlock. His dead Yugo is like his patron, his undead patron. Ooh. Also, just because he has such a variety of stuff he can do, it makes sense that he'd be a spellcaster. And then for his border trigger, I'm again really torn. Part of me wants to go Way of the Kensei Monk, because like if Yuma's not a monk in World Trigger, then who is? But then logically, I'm like, yeah, fighter samurai probably makes more sense. So, yeah. Quinn, what about you?
For Yuma, I see... I really do like the Grave Patron idea, but to go somewhere a little bit different, I almost see him as, like, Shadow Monk multi-classed into, like, a rogue. I can't remember if there's, like, a shadow-themed rogue or not, but Yuma's so... I know there's a Way of the Shadows monk or some phrasing like that that uses, like, shadow techniques.
There's a phantom rogue.
Okay, yeah, like, on flavor, by the way, because I believe the shadow monk is straight garbage from what I remember. Like, that was one of those, like, monk classes you're like, this is awful. Like, I'm never gonna take this.
Ooh, this is one to say for a one-shot, then.
I did play one for a one-shot, and the specific class features worked well for the mission we were in, but, you know, I can't comment on how they'd be useful otherwise.
But it feels like Yuma does too many, like, stealth sneak kills to not have Rogue in there somewhere. Yeah. Like, he just pops up and boom, he hits your critical spot, big sneak attack damage takes you out that way.
I guess from that point of view, yeah, I'd probably lean for single class, maybe I'd lean more into Monk, just because he'd be very dex-focused, and that also allows for decent stealth checks. Uh-huh. Miss Dale, what are the scores?
Honestly, I was going for Monk as well. I wasn't sure what exactly. Rogue makes a lot of sense as well. So strength would be like 12. Nothing too impressive, but still above average. Dexterity, I thought, would be 18. Constitution, 13. Intelligence, 13. Wisdom, given all of his experience, would be 16. And Charisma, 11. Mm. He's kind of the most boring one stat-wise. There's not really like a dump stat that would be interesting to consider.
Okay, then for Chica, I went with Rogue Assassin, just because, yeah, she seems like, you know, the type to take hides and to really focus on dispatching the enemy, and I'd give her, like, a special feature that meant that any arrow that she fires can become a bolt of slaying, to mimic her, to mimic her, like, Treon, because we have, in one of my longest running campaigns, we have a rogue who has a bolt, like a crossbow that can fire bolts of slaying, and it's just like a miniature nuke, basically.
My god. All right, Quinn, what would you say?
I mean, Chica honestly just feels like she needs to be like either a wizard that just has like a really, like, they're way over leveled for the party, so they're able to fire off spells that's like way higher, or just a warlock that's put way too much into Eldritch Blast. Like, they really have focused it, so you're like, yeah, my Eldritch Blast deals like 7d8 plus 12 damage and pushes back and stuns and knocks prone. You're just like, I hate you. You suck. I don't like you. Whoever it is, Chica's like 6 levels above the rest of the party, though. It doesn't make sense, and you're just like, fine, whatever. I'm glad she's on my side.
This reminds me, in a recent one-shot, I used my first Warlock, and it was a meme character based on Tyrannosaurus Allen from the George and Alan Volvic commercials. The challenge I set myself is, I'm not going to have any Eldritch Blast. How am I going to do this? Which was interesting. I mean, Quinn, have you seen these Volvic commercials?
It's a British thing, don't worry.
I know of Mr. Blobby. Is that the same thing? There's only so much British pop culture I can know.
I've had American friends online mention these before. God damn it, not the YouTube poop version, even though that's what... Okay, here they are.
Oh my god, I already don't like this. You know what? I'm actually kind of vibing with this volcano now, so I might be on board again.
Good old George.
I thought Chica would be some sort of a sorceress, since, like, heightened spell would really work for her. Maybe a wild sorcerer, because that's all the reference I have. I've started playing one recently as well. For her ability score, I put 7 into strength, I put 14 into dexterity, then I put 24 into constitution. I kind of equated that to her Treon, and it's insane, and it kind of ties into, like, HB, since, like, she can shield a lot. 8 intelligence, 14 wisdom. I think she's much better, like, applying things other than studying them. And for charisma, I gave her 9.
For Jin, I gave him divine sorcerer who has distant and twin spell to match the Fujin of how that works, where it can send multiple attacks quite a ways away. And the divine sorcerer is nice because it's like stuff like you can re-roll certain saving throws using divination of some kind, which ties in nicely with side effects.
Okay. What about you, Quinn?
I like what you suggested. My mind would be like, yeah, probably some kind of, like, samurai fighter, but with some kind of other class to actually give like a bit more flavor to it. But I think you kind of nailed it down pretty much exactly on that.
Yeah, that is always the temptation, because so many of the World Trigger characters fight with melee weapons, your mind immediately goes to, okay, they're a fighter class of some kind.
Yeah.
Very interesting. I actually went for, like, a bard. His whole introduction arc is like, him gradually manipulating the border administration into, like, letting Kuga stay in border. I don't know if there's, like, any bard subclass that's kind of centered around divination.
Yeah.
And for his ability scores, that's going to be, I guess, another boring one, since he'll be, you know, the OP character. I don't know, I put like 14 in strength, 18 in dex, 10 in con, I guess 20 in intelligence, because that's kind of how I intuited his side effect. 12 in wisdom, and another 18 in charisma. There we go, he had really good rolls. And I guess that's all the questions, but I think I have another question for you, Quinn. So, do you think that Aliens Area, which you recently took as the newly introduced series into your podcast, Weekly Manga Recap, so is Aliens Area filling the World Trigger-shaped hole in your hearts?
No, I will say that. So, I have heard a lot of people make the comparison that it is a little bit like World Trigger, because it is about a government agency dealing with extraterrestrial threats, and it is not a purely action series, and it is now started to be a little bit more slice of lifey. It is... If you squint very hard, like if you took my glasses off and I was at the doctor's office and you walked really far back and you held a picture of them both up, I'd be like, they kind of look a little bit similar. But unfortunately, Aliens Area does not compare to World Trigger. If you are looking for more World Trigger, I don't know where you find it. I honestly think you would be more satisfied reading sports manga than trying to find, like, sci-fi series that deal with aliens.
Yeah.
You could always try Ashihara's previous series.
The one with the dog.
The Super Dog Rilienthal, which we have recently podcasted about on patreon.com/WednesdayDailyCheddar. Anyway.
Hey!
It does really seem like Aliens Area didn't seem to really find its place as like a fighting series and pivoted to slice of life. Would you say it has found its place?
So that's a difficult question, because in truth, the series is almost certainly on its way out. I don't like to make those like strong predictions of like this series is gone. I just feel like the trajectory the series is going, it's not sold particularly well. It's been ranking pretty poorly, and there's not really any buffers right now. I don't think the series is going to last very long, and that is not a fault of the series necessarily. Shonen Jump is a very vicious beast to survive in. I don't think World Trigger would have survived if it had come out right now. That, you know, sometimes it just comes down to luck, and oftentimes finding like your rhythm and your pace and what the audience can kind of enjoy from you takes time. And I don't think Aliens Area had the time to really grasp it. It started off very like, let's be an action series, and then move to like, hey, let's do a couple slice of life. And that doesn't necessarily mean the series was going to change genre completely. It could have immediately become a space battle manga again. But it just didn't have time to capture an audience, unfortunately. So could change. I could be very wrong. And, you know, 7 years from now, we're going to be talking about how sweet Aliens Area is as it reaches, you know, chapter 400 or whatever. But I don't foresee that being the case.
Okay. To be honest, you say that World Trigger was a sports series, and it was, yes. But now I would say it's a slice of life series, so...
Yes, it is. World Trigger metamorphosizes itself every arc or so.
So there we go. Maybe Aliens Area is actually the new World Trigger, or the old World Trigger, if it does get cancelled. There we go.
Yeah. Hey, we should be answering what's going to fill up the Aliens Area-shaped hole in my heart very soon.
How does your heart have so many holes? I was going to say so many shapes, but that's all right.
You know, you got the left ventricle, the right atrium. You know, there's a lot of shapes in there.
All right, then. Shall we round off?
Yeah, sure.
Let's do it.
All right. So, this is going to do it for the 22nd episode of Duckface Diaries. You can find us wherever you listen to your podcast. Just search for Duckface Diaries and we'll be there. Links to all the platforms are at patreon.com/WednesdayDailyCheddar. Everything is in the pinned post. That's also what helps me pay the bills, so if you want me to devote more time to making the show better, consider supporting me there. In return, you can get your name in the YouTube credits or a World Trigger Duckface avatar. Plus, you can help me reach more ambitious goals like doing a special podcast podcast to cover the anime filler arc. Yeah, also the rest of Border Briefing File is now a goal. We just want to cover the volumes first, so I suppose I put that as a goal. Now, remember that much like The Neighborhood, the YouTube algorithm is a dark abyss of sorrows and woes from which channels like these never resurface, and what helps us navigate it is liking, subscribing, and sharing the podcast with a friend. On the YouTube channel and the same RSS feed, you get access to not only Duckface Diaries, but Manga Mosaic, a collection of podcasts and video essays on other manga titles short along alike. On the same channel and anchor.fm/podcastmonadventures, you can listen to Podcast Mon Adventures, our new retrospective where we cover the Pokemon special manga, arc by arc, along with the host of the Pink Ale Pod, Henry Kathman. Quinn, you also recently had the episode on the Black and White manga, right?
Yes, we just did Pokemon Black and White, and technically Black and White 2 as well.
Oh, there we go. Double that up for that. I can't believe you witnessed the adventures of Black 2 and White 2.
Dude, it's the best. I love it. Like, yeah, it's great. They were one after another, so I don't want to ask. I don't want to hang too highly on my laurels on this end because, yeah, they did follow right after each other. So it was more like, I guess we could do this, and it's just going to be more annoying to do it later on. And I think Nick didn't do it, so actually it was just me who read a bit of it.
I did love that. I do remember when last time you were covering Heart Gold and Soul Silver, and you were like, all right, we're covering Black and White, right? Oh no, fuck, there's Heart Gold and Soul Silver first, fuck.
Yeah, and then you read Heart Gold and Soul Silver, you're like, this could have been an email, like... I didn't need to read a whole series for this.
But, Quinn, where can people find you on the internet?
Well, you can find Weekly Manga Recap if you think that is an entertaining show you'd like to listen to. Pretty much everywhere. Weekly Manga Recap on YouTube, Weekly Manga Recap on Patreon. You can find a podcast on Spotify and iTunes and all sorts of places like that. You can also find Dice Funk, the show you mentioned earlier, which I may or may not be back on. Who knows? Who knows?
Ooh.
But you can find that out over, again, pretty much any platform. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, YouTube. Just search Dice Funk. And there's also patreon.com/AustinOrsky. I don't get anything from that, but Austin's a pretty good egg. So I don't know, give him some money, I guess. And then you can also find me on Twitter if you want, twitter.com/RollT. I don't post as much over there. It's usually just to throw the occasional joke in. So if you like dumb jokes and references to Jackie Chan Adventures every couple weeks, that's a good spot. Also, I have a TikTok, I should say, where I post book reviews. So that is like the content nobody wants. But if you're interested, TikTok, Quinn Spades, you can find it there.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Is your audience really into TikTok?
God, no, probably not.
I know that they're a lot into VTubers, so I would have supposed you would have capitalized on like the VTuber thirst first.
There feels like there's so much technological knowledge that has to go into that, and I don't know how to like manage that, more or less. I will say that no, our audience is not particularly big into TikTok. I like TikTok, though, and just decided to make TikTok. So that's, I want to make it clear, I have never made a career move thinking about the rising ability of it. I have simply made actions, and then consequences have come of it. Sometimes good, sometimes bad.
You know what? That's probably the right way to approach it, so good on you, yeah.
Yeah.
And Hoven, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter, at Hoven with an H. Or, and also Hoven with an H on Animist if you want to see what weeb shit I'm logging in.
Okie dokie. So once again, you can find all the links to that in the description or in the pin post at patreon.com/WednesdayDaleCheddar. And send us emails, questions, comments, suggestions at WednesdayDale012@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter at Duckface Diaries or individual Twitters at WednesdayCheddar, at Hoven with an H. And follow Quinn at RollOT and at WMR Podcast. A sincere thank you to Milo Jack Stillitz for composing music for us, an orchestral rendition of Giri Giri, the first opening sequence for World Trigger, and an orchestral rendition of Ashita no Hikari. It's the second opening sequence for the show in question, and you can find his work at soundcloud.com/milo-jack-stillitz-. Hoven, what are we covering next time?
Next time, we're covering Volume 23, which has chapters 197 to 205, and in the anime... Oh, wait. Oh... There's no more anime. This is weird. just manga now, isn't it?
I know. I am excited to see finally the draft chapters, the Away Mission draft.
You gotta find out who gets their draft picks and what position.
You know what, you're laughing, but I actually enjoyed that back then.
It is good.
Oh, my beloved characters, my beloved background characters are interacting somewhat. That's nice.
Suddenly everyone cares about what Tai Chi is going to do. Wow, this is crazy.
All right, Quinn, it was great to have you on the show, and I just remembered that I didn't send you a raven like I promised. Fuck, I'm honestly ashamed of myself, and I didn't do that. I didn't keep my promise, so terribly sorry about that.
Oh, okay. Then I need to examine the dead birds outside my window, then. That might be something different. Okay. That might be a more immediate thing I have to... I have plans now after this podcast. I gotta get on that then.
Yeah, let's go with that. Well, let's go with that. I didn't do anything wrong. Just like I didn't do when Hoven visited me in Poland, and then he left his fucking headphones, and I still haven't managed to get around to sending him those. And at this point, I'm too afraid to do that. But yeah, it was a pleasure to have you on again. I hope we can do something like that in the future.
Absolutely. Always down for it.
All right. Lovely. So, this was the 22nd episode of Duckface Diaries, and as always, it's time to
bugger off!
Oi, bugger off, eh?
There you go.